Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Going to win the war, and we are going to win the peace that follows.
Welcome to the Mighty Eighth podcast, the podcast about the people, planes, and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II, with me, Johan Tasker, and military historian Mike Peters. In this episode, we're at Seething Airfield, United States Army Air Force Station 146, about 9 miles southeast of the city of Norwich in the east of England. And we're here for the 80th anniversary of the Night of the Intruders, a ferocious raid which saw German fighter planes follow American bombers back to England and shoot them out of the sky as they tried to land. Mike, Seething was home to the 448th Bomb Group, which flew B-24 Liberators as part of the Mighty Eighth Strategic Bombing Campaign.
That's correct. It's a four-squadron group of Liberators, and we're in the 2nd Air Division country. We're deep in the heart of Norfolk here, which is very much where the 2nd Bomb Division fly from. Four squadrons, 712, 713, 714 and 715. And of course, as we always say, and whenever we do one of these podcasts, there are all the engineering support and control tower people, all the medics, etc. There's a lot more to that, but round about, roughly on most of these Type A stations, about 3,000 people.
And this is probably the first time that we've come to Norfolk, the first time that we've come to a Liberator airfield. There's a special significance here with Norwich being the county city of Norfolk.
There is, and also what we tend to forget is that Norwich is the nearest British city to Germany. So if you look back through Norwich's history, you know, it was bombed during the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by German Zeppelins, in fact. And later in World War II, it was bombed during the Baedeker raid. So Norwich was much closer to the war than some of the other cities in England, and certainly it was at the heart of bomber country. We consider the whole of East Anglia. Most people talk about Lincoln as the bomber country for the Royal Air Force Bomber Command. But if we talk about East Anglia, particularly for the United States Army Air Forces, plural, then this is certainly where it's at. And Norwich is right at the hub of all of that.
So United States Army Air Force Mission 311 on April 22nd, 1944, 2 months before D-Day, the invasion of Europe by the Allies, the Night of the Intruders, the 448th had a key role in that mission.
They did, it's a huge raid, as we'll hear later when we move through the story. This is during the run-up, this is the spring of 1944, so we're starting to think about overlord, and we're starting to think about interdiction beyond the beachheads and what the strategic bombing forces can do to assist the operational and tactical level stuff that's going to happen when Overlord is actually launched. So it's a big time. And for the United States Army Air Forces, the 8th in particular, they're starting to get their act together. They had that really tough time through the summer of 43 and then into the very bad winter of 43 where they didn't have the numbers, they didn't have the expertise, everything was just not quite right. Here we are now, coming into spring 1944, and things are starting to cook. People start to know what they're talking about and what they're doing and how to go about it. And this raid is one of those big moments, those big milestones. It's a very big raid. It's a very complicated raid, as we'll see as we get into the story of how it unfolds.
And to tell that story with us, we're joined by a very special podcast guest, author, historian and aviation archaeologist Ian McLachlan. Ian, this mission, not a widely known story until you wrote about it.
It was a local story, a legend for people living in Liberator country, which is where we are. And they remembered, and I grew up speaking to people who would always say to me, the night Jerry followed the Yanks home, wherever you went around the community, there was this battle that they referred to. And I heard about it. And then back in the 1960s, I got involved in recovering an aircraft that had been shot down that night. And like everything else, you begin to put the legend, the folklore, you try to bring it into facts. And what was the story, and there was truth in this, the story was of the American bombers returning in darkness. Question one, they usually flew in daylight. But this particular time, they came back in the darkness. And the people in the villages, like Seething, turned out to watch the spectacle of Liberators coming in, lights on, flares being fired, the thunder of engines over the community. And then the alarms go, the guns go off, confusion, chaos. A force of German intruders has got in amongst the Liberators, wolves in the flock, so to speak. And people told me of seeing aircraft hit coming down on fire. And this was what went on that chaotically dramatic night 80 years ago.
Night of the intruders, the night Jerry followed the Yanks home. We're going to look in detail at that story at that night. But first, let's set the scene, starting with the raid itself. Mike, Mission 311 was to involve the entire 8th Air Force in three waves, including the 448th Bomb Group, against the nerve centre of the Third Reich railway system.
Yeah, what we're talking about, the target is in the German town of Hamm, which is a very major rail junction just outside the Ruhr Valley. And the average daily and weekly flow through of freight through that rail junction was such that it became a significant target. The 8th Air Force had not hit this target before, so this is the first time. And they were going to launch over 800 four-engine bombers and over 1,000 fighters at this target. So this was a major undertaking, make no bones about it. And it would take some extensive planning and some quite careful coordination to get in and out the target. The key thing about the target was to actually avoid the Ruhr Valley itself. So when we look at the route that the force was going to take, they were going to come in from the north, across the North Sea. The last landfall would be Lowestoft in three separate waves. And each force would depart Lowestoft, cross the North Sea, over Holland, and then in skirting the north of the Ruhr Valley, avoiding the heavy concentration of flak that the Germans had in and around what was called Happy Valley, hit the target, and then come back up south about around the base of the Ruhr Valley, again avoiding the heavy flak concentration was the plan, and then out over northern France. So they weren't going in and out the same way. It was a round-robin, round route, and then back into East Anglia was the idea. That the critical thing would be the timing of this and the coordination of these different forces from all three divisions of the 8th Air Force would be launched and involved in this.
A highly strategic target then, one of the most important rail hubs in the eastern Ruhr area, and important to take out enemy infrastructure, their transport system, to prepare the way for D-Day.
Yeah, because ultimately once overload happens and the Allied forces are on the continent, then everybody, the Germans will know where they are and will concentrate effort towards. So what we need to do is disrupt the infrastructure, break up any resupply they got, which is, for the German military, they use the rail transport far more than the Allied troops, who've got mechanised transport and a lot more fuel to use, a lot more vehicles, etc. The Germans rely heavily on rail transport. So the Reichsbahn is literally the main artery of the German war machine. So it's quite difficult to take out individual trains, although fighters from the 8th Air Force are doing that by this stage of the war. They're hunting down trains to shoot them up. What's more effective, rather like bombing an airfield rather than aircraft, is to bomb major rail junctions and infrastructure that stops those trains from manoeuvring around and being used. Ham is a great example of that. It's a real bottleneck. And if you can hit Ham, not only do you stop stuff going westward towards where the landings will be, but actually you stop industrial supplies being moved out of the Ruhr Valley to supply the German war machine. So that's the aim of the game.
And the Americans are known for bombing in broad daylight, but this was going to be different. This was going to be bombing the target in the early evening.
Yes, and the reasons for that were that the weather conditions over the target were not predicted to give clear visibility until later in the evening, after 1900 hours. So air crews sat on bases waiting to launch. Here at Seething, for example, they kicked their heels around, not necessarily knowing why, until they got the start engines and the whole mission then rolled into gear.
And one of those air crew kicking their heels on the ground in would have been George Glavanik.
Yes, he was one of the crew, the engineer on a 448 Seething ship, Vady Ray. While they were waiting for clearance to take off, the crew got the camera out and they took some photographs standing around their ship. We can't imagine from our 21st century distance, back 80 years, to the nervousness, the fear, the rituals that they might have before they boarded an aircraft. And many air crew would have a particular ritual. They would follow these things because they clung to superstition in a way that mariners did for survival. That was common to air crew in all air forces. And that afternoon, waiting around, one can only begin to imagine, or try to imagine, what it must have felt like. Because with a mission going off, one can imagine you just wanted to get the hell on with it and get back, if you got back. You did not want to wait, and that must have tormented many of them. It did, until the flares go, the engines start, and the bomber is on its way.
And Mike, that's really, really important, isn't it? Because there's a time pressure here. We've got Operation Overlord in 6 weeks, 2 months. We can't afford to postpone the mission.
No, we can't. And if you think about it, there's 800 plus bombers across East Anglia, fully bombed up, fully fueled up. You know, all potentially an explosion in themselves waiting to happen. They need to be in the air and they need to get rid of those bombs and burn that fuel and get out of here. But as you say, quite rightly, it's about hitting that target. Ham needs to be disrupted, destroyed, whatever we can do to it. So it's critical. The things that affect a bombing mission are time, fuel, target, the enemy, all these things, and the weather, which I always bang on about, I know, but all of those things are variables. So waiting for the right visibility over the target, waiting for everyone to be in place and to be released at the same time is critical. And then once they get through their splashes and their bunch of beacons, etc., they've got to stack into this formation to get into their combat boxes, to get into their stream of bombers and arrive in the right sequence. So even from individual aircraft getting off the runway to squadrons, to groups, to combat wings, then divisions, they've all got to get into the right sequence of events to arrive at the right order over the target to drop their bombs and to come back. It's got to be done just the right way. It has to run like clockwork.
Sir George Glavanic, one of the air crew of Vady Ray. We'll hear more about George and the crew later on in this episode of the Mighty Eights podcast. You're listening to the Mighty Eights podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. In this episode, we're at Seething Airfield in Norfolk, and we're here for the 80th anniversary of the Night of the Intruders. Mike, the bomber stream is in the air. This was a huge air armada.
Yeah, it was. So we're talking now about 824 B-17s and B-24s. So we're talking really in total of 8,000 aircrew in that long stream heading it towards the target at Ham.
And those 824 heavy bombers in, they'd be protected by almost 1,000 British and American fighters.
Yes, they would. And they had a process called escort and sweep. The American fighters made a significant contribution to Allied victory, particularly when they took the reins off the Mustangs, and as an example, and allowed them free rein. For a mission like this, it would be planned that some fighter squadrons would be escorting the bombers. Now, they would not take off with the bombers. They didn't have the endurance, the fuel to do that. What they would do would have timed plans to meet the bombers as the bombers proceeded along the route to target. So a fighter group would come in, it would pick up its bomber group to escort, perhaps for 20 minutes, then it would come away and come home. Another fighter group would rendezvous, hopefully then to provide protection for the next segment. But they also had fighters sweeping. And on this particular day, the 22nd of April, notably the 4th Fighter Group from Debna had an amazing time, if you call it that, not for the Germans. They were sweeping, and the idea of a sweep is quite literally that. The planners would look at the route the bombers intended to take. The German planners would be looking at that and guessing what route would be taken. The two sets of planners would be trying to defeat one another. And the British and the American planners would plan that they would escort and sweep German fighters. We knew where the German fighter bases were most of the time. We knew for them to intercept the bombers, we had a good idea when they would be taking off. And on the 22nd of April, the 4th Fighter Group caught German fighters taking off. And they shot down 20 of them in combat that went from 30,000 feet to quite literally chasing through the treetops. And that meant that those fighters, of course, were not available then to attack the bombers.
Mike, this sweeping policy, this was a relatively new policy.
Yeah, Jimmy Doolittle brought this in. He to use that phrase that he just used, took the reins off the Mustangs and all the other fighters as well. Took the sign down off the wall about the duty being to bring the bombers home. And so the duty is to shoot down the enemy, which is what any fighter pilot wants to hear. In fact, Manfred von Richthofen said, shoot down the enemy, anything else is nonsense. And Doolittle did just that. So, but there was, as Ian's just articulated, there's a bit of a science to it. This is an aerial chess game between the two sets of controllers. And the Germans can move around their fighter launch stations, their forward bases and their fuel now and again, but really, they've still got to be within reach of the bomber stream. So it's, if everything goes right and your fighter groups rendezvous with the stream at the right time and the right place, and we've heard about in other podcasts where it doesn't always work like that. The weather's good, the fuel's good, all the rest of the fighters get there. That's great. And you've got that close-in escort and you've got that fighter sweep going ahead of you. That's all as it should be. Sometimes it doesn't work that way. And, of course, obviously, the enemy gets a vote. And even on this mission, there are lapses in the cover where packs of Fokker Wolfs are roaming around the stream because there are no American fighters there. The handover, the baton being handed over between the fighter groups hasn't quite gone to plan. The 1st Air Division, the lead air division, are on track, on the right path, and are heading to the target as they should be. The 3rd Air Division, who are the second wave, are also on track. But if we look behind them, we can see the 2nd Air Division is beginning to have problems as they bring up the rear as the 3rd Force.
So, Ian, what's going on in the 2nd Division?
Well, the Americans used an approach which would have a lead aircraft, and the lead aircraft would have two navigators on, a pilotage navigator and the normal navigator, using radar. And unfortunately, radar failed in the lead ship. Not only that, the flux gate compass went wrong. And then the two navigators on the aircraft disagreed over where they were, missing what was called the IP, the initial point for a critical turn, which leads them over what was called by the RAF Happy Valley, the Ruhr Valley, one of the most intense flak areas in the whole of occupied Europe. And that cost four Liberators, with many others damaged.
So, Mike, we've spoken about the cloud cover. There were other challenges as well in terms of strong westerly winds, which made it difficult for the planes to keep in formation.
It does. The basic thing, you've all been on an aircraft with turbulence. You've experienced that. That if you're trying to hold a tight combat box, that's a bit of a problem, winds like that. Also, a headwind. I spoke at the start of the podcast about variables, and fuel consumption is a massive variable. Headwind slows you down, makes you burn more fuel. So that also has an effect. But really, if you're in a different part of the stream and you've got your own little bit of weather there, that starts to spread things. So gaps start to open. And in the case of the Mission 311, now we've got this split division that Ian's talked about, approaching the target from different directions as well. So you've got a real mismatch of aircraft. But what you really wanted and intended was a very orderly, well, deliberate stream of aircraft arriving at regular intervals, dropping bombs on a target, because you can't arrive too close together. Otherwise, you can't see the target, because the explosions from the wave in front of you obscures your view of the target. And if you're going to be doing daylight precision bombing, you need to see the target.
And that difficulty in being able to see the target, Ian, that caused problems. That meant that not all the bombs fell on their intended target, on Ham, on the marshalling yards. Some of the planes, they were forced to go for secondary targets.
Yes, they were. The primary target, Ham, 1,518 tons of bombs fell on that target, causing some permanent destruction, which was what was intended. But unfortunately, with the navigational problems, that meant that some of the aircraft had to divert to a secondary target at Koblenz, and others, using what they called targets of opportunity, scattered their bombs on quite literally that, anywhere they could see a target that looked like worth bombing.
And Mike, in terms of fighter escort around the target, it wasn't that great, was it?
Well, where it was good. As Ian's mentioned, the 4th Fighter Group, where they were, it was very good, but there were gaps because the bomber stream had become disrupted. Therefore, your fighter cover cannot be continuous, and they're trying to find the fighters. As we've articulated earlier, the fighters arrive on a bearing at a time, expecting to meet a stream of bombers, stay with them for so long, and then they get bingo fuel, and they have to go back. So there were gaps, and the Luftwaffe exploited those gaps. One of the instances of 15 FW-190s roaming up and down the bomber stream uninterrupted is recounted in the records of the mission.
So, Ian, loads of challenges then, not only with the weather, but with enemy aircraft, with flak too. But the raid did have an impact.
Yes, the raid, we have looked at confusion, human error, problems faced by airmen in very hostile conditions. And it's easy for an historian to look back at that and say, well, this happened, that happened. Remember, these are young men. They're flying with technology that today we would consider primitive, even though it was very good for its day. Malfunctions in that technology caused problems. But overall, in the target analysis, they achieved significant destruction over Ham. Railway tracks can be repaired very quickly, and the Germans were adept at that. They had plenty of experience. Prisoners of war and others would very quickly relay the tracks. But the bombs that day destroyed some of the permanent infrastructure in the railway marshalling yards, locomotive turntables, engineering workshops, places that were still out of action at the end of the war. And that's a credit to the aircrew that flew Mission 311.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the Mighty Eights podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. We've come into the control tower here at Seething Airfield, Seething Control Tower Museum. It's a horrible April day weather-wise out there. It's blowing a gale, it's pouring with rain, but inside the museum there are some fantastic artifacts, including some from that night of the intruders.
Yeah, isn't it fantastic to be here talking about an event on the anniversary? It's the classic bomb group museum, right in the middle of nowhere, and I recommend it to people to come and have a look at, come to Seething and have a look at this group museum. Each of these Bomb Group Museums has got its own individual character and style, and this one certainly has that. And we've been shown around by some of the volunteers. It's got a nice cafe, it's really well presented, and it's got a story to tell, and it's right in the heart of liberated country.
Mike, there would have been a great sense of relief after dropping the bombs on Ham as the bomber stream turned to home.
Yes, certainly on the majority of the bombers there have been a feeling of relief. Most people describe in all of the memoirs that as soon as the weight lifted from the aircraft, as the bombs had gone, you were clear and you were turning away from the target, you were flying for yourself. You were flying for the mission before that, you flew for yourself after that. But you've still got to get home, and that's, you know, by no means a sure thing. There are still fighters to get past and flak, etc., and all the other variables that we've spoken about.
Takeoff had been in late afternoon and darkness was approaching as the aircraft returned to England. The 3rd and the 1st Air Divisions reached home early, but most of the 2nd Division was still over the North Sea at the official blackout time of 21:38 hours, 9:30.
Yes, so as the Luftwaffe night fighters were being released and vectored towards the bomber stream, 1st and 3rd Divisions were clear of the target and away from danger, but the 2nd Air Division was still strung out all the way back. Because of the navigational errors and the confusion over the target, they were running late. So it was relatively simple for the German night fighters from the Jagdgeschwader 51 to infiltrate that stream and shadow it back across the North Sea and into UK airspace. And that made them almost impossible to detect for the British radar, because they were lost in amongst that myriad of contacts from the bomber stream coming back. And for the bomber crews, because dusk into darkness is the most difficult time to get depth perception and to acclimatise your eyes to get your night vision correct. So picking out a German fighter by radar or with the naked eye was very, very difficult at that particular time.
And when we talk about German fighters, we usually talk about the ME-109, the Messerschmitt 109, or the Focke-Wulf 190, but these were different, weren't they?
Yeah, these are Messerschmitt 410s, which is a development of the old 110, so it's a twin-engine fighter. Quite over-engineered, it's a purpose-built twin-engine fighter was quite well-suited to the night fighter role, in that it could be radar-equipped, it's a two-man crew. It could loiter, it was quite agile, but also the 410 had a set of coaxial machine guns in its tail boom, one each side, which it could be operated by the gunner in the rear, and it could fire vertically, so it could fly underneath a bomber, put the machine guns up into a vertical position, and then burst up into the vulnerable bomb bay and rip out the heart of a bomber and watch it shatter and dissolve. The Messerschmitt 410 Hornet.
And Ian, the further away from the target that the bomber crews got, the easier things would seem.
Yes, they would have imagined that the threat had receded. And some air crews actually had dismantled guns and they were relaxing. The crews coming back to Seething were following standard procedure, approaching the base. But Doug Skaggs, the pilot of Vady Ray, we left him earlier, taken off, flown the mission, coming home. Worryingly, he could see flak, British anti-aircraft guns over the coast. That puzzled him. And this now is at a time, it's the last vestiges of daylight. It's almost dark, but not quite. Purple sky, dark down below. The aircraft fly towards Great Yarmouth. They go out over the sea and make a U-turn to bring them back. Then the British guns open fire. And on board Vady Ray, British anti-aircraft fire, as Doug felt it was, hit the aircraft, setting one of the engines on fire. And Doug sent George Glavanik, the flight engineer, back to have a look to see if they could do anything about the fire. Now, another procedure could be to shut the cowl flaps, shove the throttle open, try and blow the fire out. George goes back into the waist of the Liberator and he's looking out of the window. Then, unfortunately, an intruder hits them. There's a storm of cannon and machine gun fire as the ME-410 blew off Vady Ray Bombay doors, literally ripped them away. The aircraft now is in deep trouble. The engines have, the fuel lines have been hit, and George is facing a predicament, so is Doug. He can't keep the aircraft flying. The two waist gunners promptly bailed out. George couldn't, his parachute's still up on the flight deck. To get to the flight deck, he has to cross the Bombay, a very narrow catwalk with no Bombay doors and no parachute, and the aircraft is coming down. As he steps into the Bombay, he sees what looks like a couple of tormented dragons. The fuel lines have been severed, and they're lashing around under pressure and spurting fuel into flames from the engine. And they're breathing fire, quite literally. And imagine this, there he is, several hundreds of feet in the sky over a black void with all of this fire and flame around. The only thing he thinks he can do is he knows they need power. So he goes forward, he keeps one foot on the very narrow catwalk, he puts the other foot onto the fuselage side, and he manages to grab two of these thrashing fuel lines. And he holds them together with just enough power he gets through the fuel for Doug in the cockpit to recover the aircraft at treetop level, lift it over the trees and drops it on the runway here at Seething. But the cannon and machine gun fire had ripped away and burst their front nose wheel tire. So the Liberator hits the ground. It's burning. It's rolling along at over 100 miles an hour. Doug realizes that if they stop, they'll block the runway. The other aircraft can't get in. So he swings off the runway onto the grass. But poor George Glavanik is standing on this narrow catwalk. The impact of the landing throws him off the catwalk, and he's dragged along underneath the Liberator when his harness snags. Luckily for him, Doug Skaggs turning off cuts this furrow through the soil and he's dragged into it. And the B-24 rolls along and comes to a standstill with George Glavanik pinned underneath. It settles and he can't get out and it's burning above him. The other crew are, putting it bluntly, getting the hell out of there. They don't know he's down there underneath it. George is now panic-stricken. Then the oxygen tanks above him explode. That lifts the aircraft just enough for him to come out like a terrified rabbit. He's running, and then somebody throws him to the ground as he's running, just as an intruder machine guns the runway where he would have been. And that, to me, is one of an amazing story of just one man on that night of the intruders, his good fortune in surviving. And I had the great fortune to meet him years later and some of the other crew of Vady Ray to get their story and put it in the book.
Mike, an incredible story and an audacious attack by a German intruder fighter plane.
It is. And we know there were more than one, and you have to speculate as to why they didn't do it more often, because the chaos and the psychological impact of this kind of attack would really impede operations, because, you know, they're quite strict about lights and control of movement at night, etc. But actually, when you start seeing cannon shells ripping up the tarmac in front of you and hearing German engines overhead, then you think, hey, this is for real. And it would really slow things down and disrupt operations on all stations across East Anglia if they'd done it more often.
An attack like this in would have been absolutely terrifying for the returning bomber crews.
Yes, many of them admit to the fact that they were scared. And once the aircraft started going down, and some of the bomber crews wondered what these splashes of fire were on the ground, what they were Liberators impacting and exploding. In the chaos, the British guns had opened up. The American gunners apparently sometimes shot at each other, because a fleeting shadow of an aircraft, you wouldn't know whether it was an intruder or a Liberator. And so that night, the night Jerry followed the Yanks home, as the locals called it, became legendary. And for a place like Seething, the 448th had a really torrid evening. They lost four aircraft. They lost a B-24 called Repulsor, shot down with the loss of all crew at Kessingland in Suffolk. They lost another one, shot down, some say, by British guns at Great Yarmouth. And one young man on there, his story perhaps typifies so much courage, Ernest Robinson, a gunner on that. He had survived his aircraft exploding only 2 days earlier over the Channel. He was the only survivor. And he came back here to Seething, and he pleaded with the commanders here to let him fly another mission, because he would completely lose his nerve if he didn't. He was on the aircraft shot down with the loss of all crew at Great Yarmouth, and his body washed ashore a few days later. But what courage that young man had to push hard for flying that fateful mission.
Everything about the US Army Air Force in World War II was about daylight operations. And the whole doctrinal approach to flying, to daylight precision bombing, and particularly defence, was about fighting in daylight. Massed formations of flying fortresses and Liberators using their collective firepower to defend each other from German attack. Again, all based on collective defence. These aircraft were not designed to operate individually and to operate in the dark. So to find yourself in that scenario was unthinkable. To think that you would be in the dark being pursued by a German night fighter would be terrifying, because you were not trained or conditioned to think that way. It wasn't the way you would. In fact, the Royal Air Force looked at the B-17 as an example and said, the upper turret was in the wrong place for night fighting. The ball turret was in the wrong place for night fighting. The B-17 was completely unsuitable for night fighting. And the layout of the Liberator was similar, so it was equally vulnerable. So to be in the circuit above Seething with a very potent German night fighter in the darkness would be having probably dismantled your guns, having all moved into the radio operator's area to land and go through your normal drills when you're home and dry almost, would be absolutely, a catastrophic event.
We think there were possibly somewhere in the region of six intruders. And what this shows, Mike, is that an element of surprise under the cover of darkness, absolute chaos.
It does. And you know, it is like a shark in amongst helpless fish, you know, because this aircraft is designed to fight at night. The targets they're stalking are not, and they're slow moving. They're not even flying in a combat profile. They're in a circuit setting themselves up to land. It's a really, really target-rich environment if you're a German night fighter pilot.
The other thing that was to the benefit of the intruders is the fact that with so many returning heavy bombers, British radar was swamped. They launched night fighters to try and intercept, but all the night fighters found were RAF or American bombers, no intruders.
The Germans, Mike, didn't get it completely their own way, though, did they?
No, Jagdgeschwader 51 lost their commanding officer, who was lost out over the North Sea on his way home. And another of the intruders was claimed by two different bomb groups as being shot down. So two out of the probable six were lost, but still a profitable night's work if you're looking at it from a purely operational point of view.
And we can see some of the wreckage from the planes involved on that night, April 22nd, 1944, here in the Seething Control Tower Museum Inn.
Yes, you can. And you've got a small piece of molten aluminium and a photograph of the wreckage of the B-24 Vady Ray. Remember earlier we spoke about that aircraft with the crew waiting to take off, then its demise on the aerodrome, and today tiny fragments of that plane now on display here. Equally, we've got a testament to Eugene Pulsifer and crew on an aeroplane, a Liberator called Repulsor, also from Seething, shot down with the loss of its entire crew at Kessingland. And we have an airman's watch there and some other items from that aircraft. These pieces on their own are completely insignificant, but with the backstory, they represent the courage of these young men. We also have here a tiny fragment of German parachute from the wreckage of the ME-410. And that was actually picked up by an airman based here at Seething during the war, gathered as a souvenir and now donated to the museum.
And George Klavanik, who we met earlier?
George Klavanik and Doug Skaggs and Jean Gaskins, we spoke of earlier, some of the crew on Vady Ray, survived and went on after the war to live happy, successful lives. But we're as much in debt to them as we are to all the others that didn't make it through that night.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit: credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
You're listening to the Mighty Eights podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. We've come now into the Church of St. Margaret and St. Remigius here at Seething. It's an unusual church in that it's a Saxon church. It has a round tower, a thatched roof. And if we look just inside the door, there's a Stars and Stripes hanging on the wall in memory of the 448th who served here during World War II. Ian, what this tells me is that the Americans are still held with much affection in Norfolk.
Yes, in fact, throughout East Anglia, Norfolk, Suffolk and the eastern counties, what's become known as the Friendly Invasion is still fondly remembered by the inhabitants. Now the generation is fading that knew those young men firsthand. There are not many left, but their memories continue. And it has impressed me throughout my years of research just how much the communities of East Anglia have adopted the airmen and the air bases, because the history now, we're standing in a church hundreds of years old, a Saxon church. It preceded the arrival of the Americans by hundreds of years. It preceded America itself as we know it after the founding fathers. But importantly, for us now, as you step in here and you just turn around and look, you see two very simple framed pictures. They're not vast. They hang beneath the stars and stripes, and they commemorate the men of the 448th. And there are, around East Anglia, so many similar small memorials. And for me, researching this, telling the story of the Friendly Invasion, this is what brings it home. You know, you can hear the echo inside here in the church. You can look at that and you can realise, what did those men feel when they came to this church 80 years ago and looked at its history? And to be perfectly honest, we have to thank them, because they came here to help defend the freedom that we had.
Mike, in terms of the aftermath of the Night of the Intruders, where did it leave the Mighty Eighth?
Well, it certainly wasn't overlooked at the time. You know, there were numerous reports written about what had happened. And of course, at the human level, so many missing crews, so many empty seats and all the things we often talk about, it was a hard lesson learned. Really, snafu was the phrase that Ian used at the start of the podcast, and I think that's exactly what happened. If everything had gone to plan, perhaps things wouldn't have been the way they were. It's more about what the Luftwaffe did than what the US Army Air Force did, in my opinion. The fact that the night fighters were sent back with the stream, and why that didn't happen more, I'm sure Ian will have something to say about. But I think there were lessons learned about the complexities of using building such a big raid. And as I said right at the start of it, when we started this podcast, this is just after 1943, things were just starting to come together. They hit the target. They hit the target they went for, and they hit it effectively. So, you know, there were losses, and there were reasons for those losses. The reasons for those losses were identified, and the lessons were identified and learned.
And Ian, if they were so successful that night, which they were, the Germans, why didn't the Luftwaffe do this kind of thing even more?
Well, we have a gentleman to thank for that, one Adolf Hitler. He vetoed the use of intruders over the UK towards the end of 1941. And that meant at a critical period in the Allied build-up of air power, intruders were not in the skies over the UK. His reasoning, apparently, was that it was much more beneficial to the morale of the German people and showed the success of the Luftwaffe over occupied territories to shoot the bombers down over Europe. But as a quote I've got here from General Joseph Kammhuber, who set up the German night fighter defences, he said, "When I want to kill wasps, I smoke out their nest. I don't swat the insects in the air one at a time. I go to the nest when they are in." And that was the whole point of intrusion. Had the Germans done this in the period 42-43, they would have handicapped the Allied build-up. But after Hitler vetoed it, they disappeared until about the middle, August 1943, when intruders started to return to the skies over the UK. The Night of the Intruders was their greatest success against American bombers. They returned again and hit bombers over Mendlesham in June. But perhaps their greatest but also indeed costliest, was Operation Gisela at the end of the war, March 1945, when they destroyed many RAF aircraft. But had they taken this as a tactic through the war, the losses of Allied airmen and Allied aircrew would have been horrendous, because that's the time. When you're returning to your base, it's not hard to work out where you will be. You're not in vast skies, you're coming back to a focal point. When you're taking off from a focal point. Therefore, exactly as Kammhuber said, attack the wasp's nest.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Mighty Eighth podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. Ian McLaughlin's book, Night of the Intruders, is published by Pen and Sword and is available on Amazon and can be ordered from all good bookshops. And we'd like to thank Ian for being our very special guest here on the Mighty Eighth podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the Mighty Eighth podcast. And if you really liked what you heard, do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back soon with another episode. But for now, I'm Johan Tusker. Goodbye.
I'm Mike Peters. Goodbye.